Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our Deputy Editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
Hello. So this week, Matt, we are talking Horsepower with Michael Mann and Footy with Taika Waititi, plus Eating Wheat with Rebel Moon stars Sofia Boutella and Ed Skrein. And we'll be weighing up their films, Ferrari and Next Goal Wins, as well as The Boy and the Heron, Rebel Moon and Aquaman 2. I mean, Rebel Moon has a longer title than that, which we'll get to, but I'm not saying it here.
Yes.
Because it's a mouthful. Got to be snappy. So here we go. That was that. That's what we're doing. Before we get onto that, what else have you been doing this week?
Well, it's appalling of me to say this, but I've seen 5 films this week that are under embargo, so I can't reveal what they are or if they're any good. So,
You can say if they're good without saying what they are. So out of the 5, how did it fare?
I'll give you some star ratings. It wasn't a great week. The first one was 2 stars, I'd say. Second one, 3 stars. 3 stars. A 3 bordering on a 4. And then another 3 bordering on a 4. So solid, but not great. I mean, I've also been catching up on a couple of films I've missed as we get towards the end of the year. By the time this goes out, I would have also been to the launch of the Critics Circle Film Awards nominations, which I've voted in. So that's always kind of extremely exciting for me to get to sort of participate in something like that. So now the nominations are out and sort of got the next round of films to vote in for, you know, the nominees. So I'm going to try and rewatch some of those just to make sure my vote's going to the right place. But yeah, I sort of caught up on Priscilla, which I hadn't seen yet, and really enjoyed that. And also How to Have Sex, I hadn't seen. And I like that too as well.
Two excellent performances from two quite young actors, really holding their own in quite challenging material. Kaylee Spaney, Mia McKenna-Bruce. Those are probably 2 of my most intriguing films that I've seen in recent times. I'm still gunning for the Poor Things Brigade. Those that feel high on the shoulders of everything else at the moment. I've seen it twice now, and it's still a film that astonishes and really, really tickles me. It makes me burst out laughing. You know, when Emma Stone's shouting about a hairy business and frantic jumping, I'm fully on board. I love it.
I loved Poor Things as well. That's definitely on my rewatch ahead of the final round of voting films. I've only seen it once. I can't wait to give that another look.
Yeah. And Mark Ruffalo and the way he goes, ow, is excellent. Okay. So shall we see if we love what's out this week then? It's time to put your pedal to the metal with this.
If you get into one of my cars, you get in the wind. Slow.
And so?
You're going broke.
How?
You spend more than you make.
So what do I do?
Win the mille miglia, Enzo. Or you are out of business.
This is Ferrari, Michael Mann's biopic of Enzo Ferrari, the Italian visionary who changed racing and automobile history at a point in his career when his company and his personal life were at a crossroads. Before we talk about that film, let's hear what Michael Mann had to say when Faye Watson sat down with him earlier this week.
You've worked for many years on Ferrari. Was there a particular element of Enzo Ferrari's story that kept your fascination over the long period that you worked on this film?
It's the drama of these people's lives captured that reveal truths about the way we are, about human nature. And typically in motion pictures, there's interpersonal conflicts or there's internal conflicts, and they resolve at the end of the movie. In real life, they don't resolve. So these people are such a fascinating collection of oppositional forces. Enzo and Laura and that relationship, they can't live apart. They can't live together. They have periods then in 57 and later of tremendous hostility. There's a moment in time in which they were really fighting. years after 57, and the entire engineering staff of the factory came into Enza's office and said, you have to keep Laura out of the factory because she's interfering. And Enza said, oh, what? Oh, we may threaten to do something. And he fired his entire engineering staff for the whole year, destroyed the year's racing out of solidarity with Laura. They were living completely apart 2 years before she died. There's these amorous, romantic letters Enza was writing to Laura. That no one's ever seen, but Laura's doctor had them, and Penelope and I saw them. The Lena Lardy is the family in waiting, if you like. Yet when he had important clients, he brought them home to Lena Lardy's to have a home cooked dinner. So nothing is typical about any of these people. And that's what I found so challenging, and that challenged to me as an adventure. And, to get Modenese culture right, to get 57 Italy right, that goes along with the territory. And I think Enzo's very funny. And, there's a lot of humor in the film. And it's this dark, tough-minded humor.
The racing scenes in this are really electric, yeah. And they really kind of take the audience along with them. But you also don't shy away from the brutality. What was the decision behind that to kind of show how dangerous these really were?
It was a very good question. The decision for me is what do I want you to feel? What do I want you as audience to experience? And I could shoot it with long lenses and it'd be very beautiful and everything else, but that removed the audience into being observers. That's exactly what I did not want. I wanted audiences in that driving seat within the experience, within the envelope of experience of what it is. I raced and did amateur racing for about 6 years in a Ferrari Challenge. I was never very good because I kept interrupting it to go make another movie. But I may have put together three turns at Road Atlanta the correct way once and got that experience of what that was really like, where you and the car are one unit. You become organically kind of unified and harmonic, and you're just thinking something is happening at great speed, but it doesn't feel fast. It just feels smooth. And that's that high that you get that these guys all talk about, these drivers all talked about then and still do now. And so I wanted you to have that experience. You're not aware of what's happening to you in the millisecond it's happening. Okay? It's very agitated. What you're aware of, what you're focused, you have this Zen focus on what's coming next. And that's where it has to be. Here's up ahead is where, this is where, there's a point where I break, where I downshift, turn in. I took that dramatic objective, which is the same thing as saying Adam playing Ferrari could say, what's my action in the dialogue scene? It's the same, exactly the same question about the racing. I have a dramatic objective to it. And it was subjectification, to put you into that experience.
I also wanted to ask a bit about Adam playing Enzo. I know that there are some talks that he might even return with you for another film in Heat 2. But what is it about that relationship, that working relationship between you that worked so well?
We discovered that we're very similar. And that's probably why we got along so well. If there was a scene that wasn't working, Adam would be angry, and I'd say, well, what's going on? What's wrong? He'd be angry at himself. And I have the same characteristic. I place a lot of demands on myself. Adam places tremendous demands on himself. You know, we don't start blaming other people. I'm not delivering this scene. There's something wrong. Find out what it is and fix it. You know, Adam is he's the same way. And so we had a kind of a great rapport that way. The decision I made that Adam should be Enzo came from, having drinks at Chateau Marmont on Sunset Boulevard. There's something about how he's lived life, he has a raw ambition, artistic ambition, and a real ferocity behind that drive to really do this work, do it really well, and really get it. You know, you see it all over. It's a transformational performance to me. And how he moves, how he walks, the weight, how he breathes. Adam's tremendously athletic as a young guy. Everything about it and his attitude about things. He'll say Fusaro, the way he captures all the cultural gestures. And it's all intentional. There is no, I'll just show up and be spontaneous. No, this is all preparation and it's all work. I think I sensed that ferocity based on real life, real world experience. And I thought, this guy is Enzo Ferrari on the inside. The outside, you fix with craft work. And the inside, that's really key.
Yes, and just finally, I just have to ask about Heat 2. I'm so excited about that. I know you've worked on the novel, but did you ever think of it kind of cinematically when you were writing it? And are you excited to kind of see that on the screen?
It's funny because the book came out right when we're in the middle of shooting. And as a shock, a surprise, it was an instant New York Times number one bestseller, which I never expected. And I don't know how to write a novel, but I do know how to write screenplays. I approached it as if it's a very, very large screenplay in four acts, except each act, instead of having six or seven scenes, has about 130 scenes. But the narrative construction, which I spent a lot of time on, which I also do structurally on writing a screenplay, is where myself and my writing partner, where the story was all invented, if you like. And that was a document that's about 65 pages long. It was a thrill to write it because I got to go off on some tangents that you would never be able to do, make a motion picture.
So that is Michael Mann discussing Ferrari with our lovely Faye Watson. You haven't seen this, Matt.
I haven't seen it yet, no.
I saw it at Venice, so that quite a while ago. This is one that everyone was really looking forward to. And it was one of the few films that the talent could publicise that year, because obviously we were in the midst of actor strikes. So it was one that everyone was very excited about. I have to say, I was a bit disappointed when I came to it. I love Michael Mann. I do enjoy Adam Driver. But the combo of Adam Driver doing another Italian accent, a la House of Gucci, combined with some quite strange CGI moments of car crashes, Shailene Woodley doing Italian accent, I think that's what she was going for, really just made it feel very much like a TV movie, which is essentially what it is for Sky Cinema. Did it excite you, the prospect of it?
The prospect did, because obviously Michael Mann, then Adam Driver, Penelope Cruz as well, Shailene Woodley, someone I always like when she pops up in things as well. That caliber of talent I was excited by. I must admit, I'm not a car guy, but sort of with the right film, you know, you can kind of get into any sort of sport really, can't you? So I was intrigued. And obviously it did seem like one of the most exciting prospects ahead of Venice this year. But then I read your 3-star review. I know some people who've liked it more, but it didn't kind of come away with amazing reviews, considering this is like the year of Oppenheimer, you know, and you've got another kind of big director, great actor, historical
complicated
figure.
Man,
some explosive equipment. Yeah, hopes were high, but yeah, I mean, I can't say I've been left absolutely desperate to see this one, but I will catch up on it, of course. Did you find anything to enjoy in it? You kind of struggled with the accents and some of the effects.
I know, and that's not a reason to diss it. I mean, this is about, you know, a man who in 1957, he is no longer in love with his wife, Laura, played by Penelope Cruz. He's having an affair and has a child with Shailene Woodley, who he met during the war. His business is basically on the edge of bankruptcy because he's spending far more on the development of the cars than he is on actually selling them. He's selling the odd car to a very wealthy sheik here, there and everywhere. He's putting all of his cash into the actual development of them. And what he needs is, a complete change. And so that comes with the idea that why don't we put Ferrari cars in the Mille Miglia, which is the sort of cross-country car race, like Le Mans, but across sort of Italian roads. And we pit Ferrari against, you know, the other big cars trying to come through as a luxury car brand and a speedy car brand at this time. It begins with this idea of this man who's fighting grief because he's lost his son with Laura, fighting the grief of the death of a marriage, finding some happiness in his new relationship and struggling with this company. And then it moves into the actual task at hand, which is the race. Getting the car ready, finding the best drivers, including Patrick Dempsey, to race these cars across this racing all day, all night race that's along tiny roads through, you know, hairpin bends in towns with little more than hay bales protecting spectators. Then you get into this quite racy, literally, portion of the film that is really quite good. And that's the bit I enjoyed, I think. I think it took me too long to get to that bit that was actually cars revving and the idea of cars in 1957 having zero safety features and pedestrians and spectators being completely unprotected from the possibility of a crash. And within that, there is a truly horrific incident that happens. And also some quite amusing things, you know, people sort of trundling off into fields and having to leave their beautiful red Ferrari in the middle of a field and walk back home. It's a bit sort of those Magnificent Men in their flying machines at that point. But never did I really feel fully engaged in Enzo Ferrari's inner life and his real passion. Driver plays him very much as a sort of stoic, sort of elegant Italian man. He's often hiding behind his sunglasses. You never really truly know what he wants apart from to win this race. So that was difficult to sort of get a hold on. Whereas it's very easy to understand who you're supposed to be gunning for in an actual race. You want Ferrari to win. So when they're in these really quite sort of breathtaking races on the road and tussles with the cars getting forward by an inch and back an inch, that's quite engaging. But yeah, I think as a whole, it doesn't quite measure up. And I just couldn't really get engaged. And also as well, you know, you and I were fans of Le Mans.
Yes, I was just about to ask you about that.
Yeah. And so we've already seen a portion of Enzo's story within that and the idea of, you know, underdogs with a great car in that film, Ford, trying to go up against, you know, the big guns. I really think I enjoyed Le Mans more. And also I felt like I had seen that all day, all night racing done really quite well. So it felt almost like I didn't need to see this film.
Yeah, because that was only a few years ago, 2019, wasn't it? And in other countries other than the UK, it had the much better title of Ford v Ferrari.
Yeah.
So
does what it says on the tin
really
there.
Kind of had that. This does feel quite soon after that, doesn't it? To, especially if it's not going to come out absolutely amazing. So that's a shame then. But I will still be giving it a watch. Looking forward to seeing the bits that sort of do work when we get on the racetrack.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, if you love Michael Mann, you're going to want to see this, aren't you?
Yes.
You're going to want to see his latest effort and what interests him as a director. You know, there's all this talk about Heat 2 being made. You know, before we get to that, this is what we've got to look at. And, you know, he's an elegant filmmaker. You know, this is very nicely done. And if you love classic cars and you love the roar of an engine, you know, and the nerdiness of what's under the hood, then this will probably do it for you. But if you just got a passing interest in it, I don't know that there's enough human drama to really engage you.
How's Penelope Cruz in? Because, we haven't talked about her much yet.
Yeah, no, and she's very fiery. And, you know, Penelope Cruz always gives good Penelope Cruz. Yeah. And I love her doing Italian films. I love Limoncita, which she did last year. She does quite a lot of Italian work. So for me, her accent was slightly more believable than other people's in this. And I did like the fact that she is a woman of a certain age who has been cast aside by a man who's only interested in the next thing, but that she holds a stake in this company. She owns half the shares and therefore she cannot be ignored. And she makes sure that she isn't. And, you know, Penelope Cruz is great. I just wish she was in something a little bit better. If you love her, this is her just doing her thing. But not enough of her, I'd say.
You just tell from seeing her on the poster, this was going to be another Penelope Cruz performance I enjoy. You can just tell even from that, she's giving off that classic Penelope Cruz sort of energy and attitude.
Yeah, a woman that will not be ignored, in the words of Alex Forrest in Fatal Attraction. She is always that in every film, and she's, you know, a cracker here. Okay, so if you fancy a bit of Ferrari, checking out what's under the hood of that, it is on Sky Cinema this Friday, and it's at limited cinemas as well, so you can see it on the big screen. Right, from racetracks to footy pitches now, it's this. If you're all
haven't scored one goal in the history of our country trying to have a soccer team.
Goal! They scored again. Humiliation.
Mark my words. Things are going to change. I got us a new coach.
Something to drink?
Whiskey, beer, wine?
Yep, we got all those. Which one?
Whiskey, beer, and wine.
This is Next Goal Wins, the true-ish story of the American Samoan team, which lost 31-0 against Australia. And they brought in a new coach to lead the team in their 2014 World Cup qualifying campaign with the objective to score just one goal. It's not much, is it? Just one goal. Writer-director Taika Waititi sat down with you, Matt, to talk about the film a few weeks ago. Did you manage to stay on topic?
Just about, because actually in this interview, he's paired with Jaya Salua, who's a character from the film, you know, that you get to meet in the film. This is the real person that the character in the film is based on. So that helps keep things slightly more on topic. But as ever, whenever I've interviewed him, I very much was trying to stifle laughs throughout, just because I find almost everything he says funny, basically. So have a listen to them both now.
Coach, you've got the toughest job on the island.
All we want is just one goal. One goal.
Come on, guys!
We've worked too long and hard for this.
You've only been here a few days.
Taika Waititi and Jaya Saliwa, thanks very much for joining us on the Inside Total Film podcast. And now, this is quite an unusual setup because, Taika, you're the director and writer of Next Goal Wins, and Jaya, you appeared in the 2014 documentary of the same name, which this film is sort of loosely based on. So for anyone who isn't aware, Jaya, could you first introduce yourself and tell us a bit about the documentary?
In 2011, I was recognized by FIFA as the first out transgender person to play in a FIFA-sanctioned tournament. And it was immortalized in a documentary that was shot by Archer's Mark, based here in London. Steve Jamieson and Mike Brett came to American Samoa to film what it was about my team that kept us from playing football. And they quickly realized that there were many different characters in our team that could make a potentially good documentary. And so they released it in 2014 at Tribeca Film Festival. And from that point on, a platform was created for me where I could, you know, educate communities about the Fafafine identity and about the Samoan culture. And then I was on FIFA's radar for a little bit, and I've done a lot of work with them for their diversity program. Yeah, and just recently I was named a FIFA legend by President Infantino and Secretary General Fatma Samora at the Women's World Cup.
From one legend to another. Kia ora, I'm Taika Waititi, and I made the adapted film slightly fictional mm-hmm. version of the documentary, which is out now, which takes the events of the 2014 documentary, which was actually in 2011 mm-hmm. when it was shot, which follows the team, the American Samoan team, on its quest to score a goal and win a game, thus breaking the biggest losing streak or non-winning streak in history.
And Jaya, like, how did you feel like when you heard this was going to be made into a sort of semi-fictional film?
Initially, I was indifferent because I had already done the tour for the documentary, but we heard it was Taika, and I was excited that, you know, someone who is a Pacific Islander is going to be able to tell a Pacific story in his unique way. But I was also very anxious and nervous about who was going to portray me. So a lot of things, but turned out to be one of the biggest projects that I am blessed to be a part of, but also, you know, being a part of the tour and promotional work for the movie has really changed my life and opened my eyes to the possibilities of my people's culture and the Fafafine identity being amplified in a way that I would never have imagined.
And did you work together on the casting at all, or do you kind of step aside
at all
on the film?
I stepped aside and...
No, she stepped aside and I took over and
power.
I did whatever I wanted with
power.
The goddamn
yes.
story.
Yes.
Okay? Because I'm a filmmaker, man. I'm an auteur. I took a lot of those elements that I really loved in the film and I started making more of some of the characters, and like, for instance, you know, some of the liberties I took were Jaya and Thomas's relationship, which didn't occur like that, and I made more of that because I wanted to show the sort of father-daughter sort of parallel there, and that which, you know, helped a lot with his character development. Mm-hmm. He wasn't as much of an asshole in real life. He's actually a really big sweetheart.
But he can be.
He's a larger-than-life character, and you know, which we kept those elements, but he needed to be more lost in the beginning of this film to have somewhere to go. Gail was still with him at the time, but then they did separate. And one of the other main things, my favourite thing now, is Jaya. I gave Jaya's character in the film two goals in the game, which apparently never happened.
Now we'll accept that as the reality.
But since I've done it, it has happened, so it's real.
Yeah, but also it's nice to see, you know, a trans person having a lead role in a huge film. I thought that was, you know, a huge nod to the Fafafine identity, but also trying to make light of the current climate that's, you know, around trans women in sports.
And also it's just important to show the world that there are cultures who have been accepting of people's identity mm-hmm. or different identities and the way that they, you know, they want to be. For a very, very long time. Yeah, there's a long history of this, and it's a sacred thing, and it's a respected thing, and it's a nurtured thing. And I think, yeah, for the West to still be mm-hmm. obsessing with how what someone else wants to do with their life and their body is pretty sad.
And so from early on, was Jaya one of the more prominent characters among the players?
It was always my intention was to make Jaya a bigger character and to focus on it. And also Thomas, and also just sort of like play with the idea, this white savior idea, and like look at all the cliches and the tropes from other versions of these films and use those, but do them in our own way with our own twist, mm-hmm. like make them a bit more ridiculous.
And what made you think of Michael Fassbender for Thomas? And then what did you then think of that casting when you heard?
Just because I wanted someone who's known for his comedy in films like Shame and Hunger and 12 Years a Slave. And just thought, you know, if he could carry that wonderful ability across into my film. That was a real surprise, actually, to see how funny he could be and how great at improvising he was.
He was so Thomas in many ways, the way he spoke and the mannerisms that he had, but also, you know, his obsession with football and having a drinking and smoking problem was relatable to the actual Thomas, but not in the way that it was portrayed.
The film sort of very affectionately sends up the culture on the island. Are Polynesians very self-deprecating when it comes to the humor?
Oh, that's
film?
All we do.
All the time.
We're self-deprecating and also give each other a lot of shit mm-hmm. in between the islands. There's inter-island mocking and poking fun of.
A lot of little things in the movie that only Pacific Islanders would get that, you know, specific to our humor.
Yeah, there's some historical beef between Samoa and Tonga. And so, like, it's, you know, and that is the real teaming up for that game, which, again, is like a great thing to play with because it's like, you know, because Samoans and Tongans would understand the stuff that we're doing with, like, yeah, when they come in, like, the bad guys from Karate Kid and stuff, and we're like, villainizing those guys. And that's all part of that humor.
And just to wrap up, Taika, when we last spoke in TIFF, the actor's strike was going on, so you weren't sure what was happening next, but you said you were hoping to do Clara and the Sun in New Zealand. Is that still the plan for next year?
It's still the plan. I haven't become more motivated in my writing, unfortunately, but that is definitely the plan. One thing I've learned from this film, and I think maybe a good thing, maybe it's a bad thing, is, you know, you can make plans, but just get ready to let them go, and, and work's not very important. You know, make sure you enjoy your life. Just I think I'm now just doing, I don't know if I want to work again.
So this is Next Goal Wins, and obviously Taika and Jaya talked about that there. But Matt, quick logline, what is this about? We obviously talked about the 31-0 World Cup disaster. Who are they bringing in and what do they hope to achieve?
Yeah, so if this sounds at all familiar, it is because in 2014 there was a documentary about this team and by the same title, Next Goal Wins. So you may have seen that already, or if not, this tells a similar story, but a slightly fictionalised, where you have this Dutch-American coach, Thomas Rongen, who here is played by Michael Fassbender, and he's kind of at a low ebb of his career. And so he's basically given the option of going and coaching the American Samoa national team, who are considered one of the worst football. And we're talking soccer type football for us kind of English people here. So what we call football. And they're just a sort of comically bad team. And as you mentioned, yeah, like they famously lost 31-0 in one of their kind of previous matches. I think it was the worst World Cup performance ever, I think. I mean, yeah. I don't see how anyone could score more than 31 goals because you're literally putting away a goal every 3 minutes with that. I don't know how it's actually done. I would like to watch the whole match one day. But yes, so then you get this guy, I mean, as portrayed in this film by Fassbender, he's very grumpy, doesn't really want to be there, and goes to this idyllic place, and he's got kind of quite a low bar. based on their previous performance. So they're really looking for just one goal, really. They just want to be slightly less of an embarrassment, and they'd love to sort of get a goal in a World Cup qualifying match. Then we're into basically classic sports movie territory, as he has to sort of whip this bunch of no-hopers into some sort of shape and make a team out of them. And you've also got in there this culture clash element as well, because you've got this kind of grumpy coach, kind of, you know, from, I think he's spent a lot of his time in America, although he's also, he's kind of Dutch-American, but yeah, and he's got to basically with them in soap, and they're kind of like, they're a very comedic bunch here, of sort of varying skill levels, but none of them are that great, and they've not really trained properly, so they're just completely at odds with each other, basically, and he's got his work cut out to get them into shape, basically, for competing.
Yeah, so it's fish out of water. He's also dealing with some tragedy in his own life and sort of drinking problem. So there's a sort of salvation in at work here. And there is a player who is in the process of transitioning, and that is Jaya, who we just listened to in the chat with you, Matt. So yeah, there's sort of all sorts of culture clash, ideological clashes, and the idea of what American Samoa is in the world and how it's a bit of a sort of joke to people, but, you know, that there is this quite rich culture and this community at work on this island. All of that's going into that. Plus, you've got Taika Waititi as a minister with huge teeth that turns up as a bookend at the beginning and the end and a bit in the middle, doing his comedic accent. There's a lot going on. It's supposed to be heartwarming. Did that warm your heart?
I reviewed this film out of the Toronto International Film Festival where it premiered. And obviously there, you're kind of just reviewing blind, because you see the film, and then you obviously, embargoes haven't lifted yet, so you're just writing your review with not knowing what anyone else thinks. And I really enjoyed this a lot, but I was in quite a minority when the reviews came out, that I was one of the rare positive ones I saw. What I'll say, you know, in its defense is, as I mentioned earlier, I'm very much on Taika Waititi's wavelength when it comes to comedy. Like, I just find him very funny. I find his films very funny, you know, like, and his dialogue and the way the characters talk, this kind of self-deprecating humor that you see, you know, in American Samoa, and how everyone knows everyone, and
they'll have like three different jobs, don't they? Yeah. So like the person that does this, you then turn up and they'll be serving at the bar, and then they'll also be fixing your car. It's like that sort of comedic thing.
And the guy who's filming him when he arrives for the sort of local TV show. So there was a lot I found funny in it. I mean, it's very much formulaic sports movie 101, in the sense that it truly just sticks to the underdog sports movie formula, where you kind of know exactly where it's going to go from the beginning.
It's like Cool Runnings or something, isn't it?
And it doesn't have any sort of massive surprises in that way. But that said, it didn't try and be anything other than that. So I sort of thought, on its own terms, as a fun, funny, feel good sports movie, I actually just thought it delivered. I just found it funny. I did find it quite heartwarming. I like the way they did the speeches and the climactic match, and things didn't play out quite exactly how they always do. So there was a little bit different in the delivery to keep it feeling a little bit fresher, but while still kind of having the beats that you want really in this kind of film. But I know a lot of people didn't like as much. So I mean, where do you fall, Jane? I don't know where you fall on it.
I didn't like it. All of those things that you're saying that you kind of liked the familiarity, I found were really just so by the numbers. And there was also the slight sort of whiff of white savior complex going on here. I didn't enjoy Taika Waititi. I feel like he was just doing what I've seen him do before. And he turns up and he's like, hello there. Here is a story from this island. Yeah, you might not believe it, but you might. That is, I apologize profusely to Taika and anyone of those nations. So he's doing that thing he does in Guardians again, which is very funny in Guardians, but I've seen it before. And there was montages, and there was like heartfelt confessions, and then there was random people that were in it for 5 seconds, like, why is his ex-wife, played by Elizabeth Moss, she's in it for literally two scenes. I feel like a load of that was cut out. Then there's obviously the Armie Hammer was originally in this, and he was taken out after the sort of difficult accusations that were made against him, and he was replaced with Will Arnett. Again, he's in it for zero time. There's a weird daughter thing going. I just felt it was really quite tired and tiresome. I didn't find it very funny. I really enjoyed looking at the beautiful landscapes. I thought you know, some of the actors playing the team were very charming. I did not find Taika charming.
He's not in it loads. So if that's a big concern of anyone's, I'd say don't worry too much about that. It's very, very much a cameo.
He also, like, he's trying to hang on to that Marvel-esque vibe because he puts an end credit sting in there as well, which features himself.
I actually did laugh at that, though. I mean, it's a very throwaway final little joke. If you've enjoyed it thus far, I hung on and I laughed a lot of that. But if you haven't enjoyed the film, you'll probably just be even more irritated that you've stayed around for that. I would say as well, yeah, like, I mean, I wouldn't get your hopes up too much because, like I say, for me, it worked within this very basic framework and this very, very predictable formula. But yes, it's just strange. I suppose perhaps as we've sort of discovered today, maybe if it just chimes with your sense of humour, you'll obviously get on more with it, I suppose. And I do kind of admit that I seem to be an outlier.
And also, like, I'm sorry, Matt, but Michael Fassbender trying to do, like, broad comedy. I felt for him. I didn't think he was really at all comfortable doing that. Did you?
I liked him in it. I think partly because I was just, you know, it was nice to see him again after so long when he kind of had his comeback with this and The Killer. But to me, it kind of worked because he was the grump, you know, the grumpy outsider who doesn't quite fit in with these sort of laid back, you know, island folk. So I kind of thought like it worked really for me in that sense. But I mean, I wouldn't say he necessarily seemed like I'd want him, you know, leading a comedy as the funny leading man, if you know what I mean. But I thought he worked here. And I also will add as well that part of it for me, this appeal you can just get with film sometimes is it was actually shot in Hawaii. The infrastructure's there to kind of shoot in the way it's not in American Samoa. But it just looks so nice. I just felt relaxed just seeing the sort of settings and the scenery. And in that way that, you know, you get with film sometimes where you just get transported away to somewhere a bit nicer for a little while, that made the film go down much easier for me as well, because I was like, you know, it's like a nice little holiday here.
Yeah, but I mean, do you want to pay your cinema ticket just to see a nice beach? I'm not sure I do, you know, and sort of weird caricature sort of cartoonish versions of people that live there. I mean, it's in a vein of a low here.
Good nooning.
And tonally really weird. And I feel like it's been hanging around for ages, hasn't it? I mean, how long ago was it made? Like,
well, I mean, it was shot before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And then obviously Taika had to go off and do another Thor film. So it just kind of got completely sort of put to the side.
And then you've had to edit Army out and do reshoots and then faff around. And it feels like that has happened to it. It doesn't feel coherent to me. And yeah, it just feels very old fashioned. So sorry. Mm. I'm going to say that is a yellow card for me. It's a warning, Taika, up your game or else you're off. But for you, you're just saying play on.
It's a play on for me, yeah.
Okay, all right. See what you think to Next Goal Wins. Is it offside or not? It is out in cinemas this Friday.
Football is life.
From an island world to another world now, it's this.
Mahito.
So, you made it.
Mother!
Have a seat.
It's this way, Mahito.
A lot of strange things happen in this place.
Please join us. I just hope he stays safe.
Save me.
Save me, Mahito!
What exactly are you?
Dear mother. She's awaiting your rescue. I'll be your guide.
This is The Boy and the Heron. There's a boy in it. There's most certainly a heron. What else is going on, Matt?
So again, this is another film that I reviewed out of Toronto this year.
And you were correct with this one. Just let's say that.
Okay, thanks. And it's tricky because sort of reviewing sight unseen, although this film had come out in Japan, and it had been a huge hit. But when it was released in Japan, they revealed virtually nothing in advance. There was no kind of pre-release promo or anything like that. It was all really on the strength of this being another film from Hayao Miyazaki, the sort of master who co-founded Studio Ghibli. it was kind of talked up as his last film, even though in the time since there's been sort of a lot of talk that it won't be his last film and that he's working on more stuff as we speak. But it was kind of sold in that way. Basically, the big selling point of this was Miyazaki's back. It's his first film in, I think, 10 years on classic territory, if you're a fan of his and a fan of Studio Ghibli. And many people have interpreted it as being somewhat semi-autobiographical for Miyazaki. To set up the basics of the story, we begin during the Pacific War, 1943, and there's a young boy whose mum is killed in hospital during this kind of bombing of Tokyo at the beginning. And in this quite amazing sort of expressionistic opening, what happens after that is the young boy, Mahito, he goes away with his dad, who remarries his wife's younger sister. So they go to live in the countryside. There, basically, Mahito's obviously kind of like, you know, dealing with all this, and this bizarre heron appears basically and leads him to a tower, and then he enters this mysterious kind of upside down world, really, this sort of fantasy world through there. And the rest of the film kind of plays out after that, with Mahito kind of coming to terms with his grief and the loss of his mum, and also dealing with these bizarre fantasy creatures at the same time. In a lot of ways, it did remind me of sort of Miyazaki family classics like Spirited Away, thinking about this sort of weird alternate world, and My Neighbor Totoro, thinking about there you've got the mum off sick in hospital and the children kind of, you know, dealing with that whilst also meeting these strange fantasy creatures in this sort of remote countryside place they've moved out to stay at. So there's the sort of familiar elements there. Whilst for me, on first viewing, this didn't quite hit the highs of those, which I think are just, I mean, almost impossible to hit anyway. I did really love this film and the world it evoked and the sort of poignancy of it all as well. How about you, Jane? What did you think of it?
I feel like it's this is really quite weird compared to other ones. It really demands that you just marinate in these beautiful images and nonsensical turns of narrative. And, you know, there's herons that have men inside them, and there's giant parakeets that are soldiers, and there's fire maidens, there's these little blobby things, warawaras, I think they're called, that float about. There's all sorts of things going on here. And it really feels like there's no right interpretation of it. So it could be quite frustrating for some. But for me, I just went along with it and was like, oh, this means this and that means that. And I don't really want to be told what it actually meant. For me, I took my own interpretation away from it. And it was a story about a boy coming to terms with his own rage and malice is the word he uses, about his mother being taken from him, and the strength and the journey it takes to accept another woman into your life as part of your family, and the journey you need to go on in order to accept that woman as your new mother. There is no evil stepmothers here. There's no really terrible people. It's all very grey, isn't it?
Yes.
People have motivations that aren't brilliant, but nobody's a baddie. So it's very much about sort of moving through these amazing worlds. It's a bit labyrinthy. It's a bit Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. There's all sorts of things going on there, and sort of taking your own interpretation out of it. So from that point of view, I thought it was an absolute trip, and I really enjoyed it. But equally, I could imagine if I saw it on another day where I had less patience, I might have just been like, well, what the hell is going on here? What are all these toads climbing up this child about?
Did you see it in the Japanese language version? Yeah, that's what I saw as well, the subtitled Japanese language version when I saw it at TIFF. The English dub has got this absolutely amazing voice cast, including...
Yeah, the heron is Robert Pattinson.
So you've got Robert Pattinson, Gemma Chan, Christian Bale, who obviously was in Howl's Moving Castle, Mark Hamill, Florence Pugh, Willem Dafoe, Dave Bautista. Dave Bautista's the Parakeet King. I can really picture that, obviously remembering the parakeets from the film. I can really picture Dave Bautista. I'm desperate to see the English language version because, one, they always do a great job with these. Okay, maybe this makes me a bit of a philistine, but I actually prefer to watch the Studio Ghiblis in the English dubs, because whilst I would never watch a live action film dubbed, I think because of the nature of animated films, just inherently they're dubbed as it is, I think it's perfectly fine. And for me, it's just, it just takes away a barrier where you can just get all the more immersed because you're not ducking your eyes down every so often, sort of thinking about reading. Plus, they just have these great cars. So I'm just interested to see what they do with it as well. So, yeah. So from the trailer,
it seems like Robert Pattinson and various other talent are really embracing the performances of the original actors that voiced. So, you know, this heron has this voice that's very, hello, I'm a heron. And that is what Pattinson is doing in the dub. So I feel like it's less of an offensive dub than it would be of just, you know, somebody going, hi there, how are you doing? I'm a heron. You know, he's just, it is very much in the spirit of the intended sort of vibe of it. So I don't think it matters whether you watch it in either version. But yeah, I'd certainly like to see it again with the English, because I'd like to see Florence Pugh as this sailor girl that, you know, captures these big fish and looks after these warra warra little floating things. I want to see her do that. I want to see Batista as the parakeet king. He's a mighty beast. The parakeets are really quite chubby and amusing, aren't they? Yeah, it's a complete trip.
I got lost a tiny bit at some points in terms of plot. I don't know if you felt the same. So
yeah,
I wondered if, you know, like again, just get more into it perhaps on second viewing if I was seeing the English language dub. We should also add as well that I would say this is rated 12A by the BBFC. I would say it's suitable for children, but as you mentioned, it is quite freaky in places. Yeah. And it's one of those things that this is like a, you know, an animated film. And I'd say broadly speaking, suitable for families, but doesn't shy away from obviously dark themes. Is that opening is quite intense. The bombing and the death of his mother
in fire is really quite alarming.
Yeah. And this is one of those sort of animated films where characters really kind of bleed and there's a lot of kind of grotesque imagery. You know, even when you just see, like, you know, just a fish being kind of prepared, it's kind of gutted and its guts sort of hang out. And so it's just not like, it's not sort of softened at all in that sense. So I would kind of say to everyone to kind of bear that in mind, and that it is a 12A, and check the advice if you are thinking of taking children, because, yeah, these films, they don't never really sort of shy away from things like that.
Yeah, and I mean, the heron, one of the things that could haunt your dreams, couldn't it?
Because sometimes you just see the kind of teeth, you know, peeking out from when the beak's a bit open. Other times he has the kind of head pulled back. So it's a little like gnome-like man's head sort of sticking out the top. And I think in my review, I sort of said, it reminded me a bit of a football mascot taking a sort of half-time breather, you know, where it's a man in this weird bird costume with his head poking out the top. The warra warra are very cute, though, as you mentioned. That kind of balanced it out a bit for me.
But even then, the warra warra are subject to horrific attacks by we won't say what. But, you know, like, they come in and you think, oh, okay, after sort of journeying across oceans with huge sea monsters and, like, raging seas, we're now going to have a breather with this lovely interlude with these warra warras that are like sort of marshmallow ghosts of little giggling creatures that float and bounce about. Gorgeous. And then, in the middle of this beautiful moment where they're sort of floating about, something horrific happens. And again, if you had kids that were quite sensitive, you might have tears in the cinema at this point. But that's what I liked, that it was like, all bets are off. You had no idea what was coming next, where it was going, what it was even really about. I mean, at some point, I'd like to read the director's vision and what each thing meant. But at the moment, I'm just sitting quite happily with all those images in my head, taking my own interpretation from it, and I'm enjoying it. I would highly recommend this as a just out-of-body experience. Would you recommend that people go and see this? It is out, you know, the week of Christmas. Is this what you want to watch? This or Wonka?
Wonka will go down easier with a bigger family, I think. But this is the better film for my money, definitely. And if you're in the mood for it, and, you know, based on everything we've said, this is definitely the better film. And it's kind of up there in the best films of the year for me, really. Definitely being my sort of top 20 or so. And I know some people who kind of rate it even more highly. So maybe it'll go up even more in my estimations on a second viewing. Yes, it's very, very much recommended by me, this one.
Yeah, me too. I would say go and watch this. It's completely not anything else that you'll see on the telly or on the cinema this Christmas. And for that reason, it is worth every penny. It's in cinemas from Friday. Right, it's time to look at Zack Snyder's latest. It's this.
What do you think they want?
Everything.
I found her.
I am a child of war. I was taught that love is weakness.
there is a difference between justice and revenge.
There is a price to pay for your defiance.
Shh, one moment. I do love this part.
So this is Rebel Moon, part one, A Child of Fire. Love's a long title. But before Matt and I deduce whether it is any good or not, let's listen to what Sophia Boutella and Ed Skrein, stars of this, had to say when they sat down with Molly Edwards earlier this week. And they talked about Wheat and Lady and the Tramp. Find the connection. Here we go.
Who among you is willing to die for what you believe?
Kaur is like this really strong, incredible warrior, but with this really mysterious, like complicated past as well. And you know, at times she's really vulnerable, but she's also like doing these epic fight scenes. And I was wondering, like, what did you make of bringing such a complex character to life, especially considering like a lot of the Zack Snyder movies have these really like strong female characters, and now you get to be a part of that.
Zack loves to empower women. You can see in all his movies, women have their own voices. Even 300, the wife, Zack is really inspired by his mother. Was really like, she was such a tough and strong woman, and you can see that he loves putting women up there. And I just love that he was given the opportunity and allowed to give this movie a woman as a lead, and not only that, but a woman who with a strong ability, but that comes from a very, very particular and complicated past that gives her that vulnerability. That was, for me, fun to play, because it's just going and fighting and just enjoying it for the sake of it, because it's going to look amazing because this is a Zack Snyder movie, was too easy in a way. But doing it with a resistance, I think, is more interesting, even for the audience to observe. It's like not just going full force towards it, but resisting as much as possible every single time, I think makes it more interesting for Kaura.
Do you know, I really feel, when you're speaking now, I'm thinking, yeah, like we were so lucky that we had characters that, if we had no fight scenes, would have been so interesting to play.
Yeah,
there's absolutely so much emotion and so much range and so much tension that as an acting job alone, it was delectable.
Yeah.
And then the fight scenes. We get to do fight scenes in and be shot by Zack and work with Spider and Mel and the greatest stunt guys in the world. Like, we're so lucky on both levels.
That's why I've never thought of that, that if the fight scenes weren't there, it would have been such a fun and movie to play and even to watch, because the characters are not... He didn't write a story that is just a go-to story, like with just already written storylines. Mm. It's really different what's written in this project, and you'll find out more in movie number two of their complexities.
And in the extended cut.
And, you know, speaking of part two, I was going to ask about that as well, because it's coming in just a few months, and it feels like, you know, we have this massive cliffhanger, and it feels like there's so much more for both of you to do. So without getting into spoilers, can you kind of tell me what we might expect from you both?
No, we can't. There's a scene where we do, like, Lady and the Tramp with the spaghetti.
Yeah. But it's with a piece of wheat.
No. I mean, I think just more. I think that's the amazing thing about it, is, like, I hope people enjoy the movie and get to the end of it and are like, wow. And the idea that we've already shot a whole nother, exactly what you've seen, but again, and then some, because of the extended cuts, you know, that you have hours and hours and hours on top of this, I think that's what's interesting and exciting about it. I suppose it's like the difference between a limited series and a series that goes on. It's like, oh, we've got seasons of this. If you're into it from the pilot, then we've got a lot for you.
For movie two, I mean, I think you'll get more context, going deeper with each and every characters. And there are no characters that are left aside. And it goes really deeper with every single person. You get the backstory and get to understand why they're where they are and why they're who they are.
Also, I don't know if I'll get in trouble for saying this, but I remember, I'm going to say it anyway. I remember Zack saying with the second movie that he kind of wanted it to feel like Dunkirk. There's a space at the beginning, and then it's going off. And it's really, really going off. And, you know, Return of the King, Lord of the Rings vibes, where it's like, okay, we kind of know where they're going. It's like, all right, now let's just sit back, eat loads of popcorn, and watch it all kick off.
I've only seen a snippet of this. I've seen about 20 minutes. Haven't seen the full film. Have a real sense of what's going on. Mm. But set it up for us. Where is the Rebel Moon? Who's the Child of Fire?
I've actually seen the full film, and I've seen it in IMAX as well. So obviously most people are probably going to be watching this at home on Netflix. Even it has had a very small cinema release, but I obviously saw it in IMAX massive scale, which I feel like it sort of warranted, really. But yes, it's one of those films that it starts you with a bit of a voiceover narration by Anthony Hopkins, who voices a robot type character in the film. It was one of those ones that instantly I was like, well, I couldn't really keep up with what they were saying. But basically the general gist was there'd been a long line of kind of, you know, a long ruling of these benevolent kings and leaders. But basically,
All gone to pot.
It's gone to pot.
Got an awful one.
This military force called the Imperium has been created. And we then pick up, you know, quite a few years later after that, we've got this character, Cora, played by Sophia Boutella. And she's living on this farming colony on a place called Vite. Yeah, and basically she's living a kind of peaceful farm-like existence with these kind of, you know, simple farm folk. And along come the Imperium, basically say, we need your food. We're gonna take it all. It's one of those kind of stories. And so what happens then for the bulk of this film is we have Cora heading off on a journey to basically round up a bunch of warriors that she thinks can help defend them for when the Imperium, which is led by Ed Skrein's Atticus Noble, when they want to be ready for when they return. So she goes to find a bunch of warriors to help stand up for this farming colony. Along the way, she kind of picks up, like, there's Jaimon Hounsou, Charlie Hunnam, Michelle Huisman, Duna Bay, Ray Fisher, who people will remember from Zack Snyder's Justice League. They all feel like variations on classic sort of sci-fi and fantasy characters. As you may well know, this was nearly a Star Wars film. I mean, the title feels very Star Warsy.
The Imperium are essentially stormtroopers, aren't they?
So the Imperium is basically the Empire. They very much lean on the sort of Nazi insignia as well. Yeah, so basically this was once nearly a Star Wars film, but instead it kind of became an original with Netflix. And as the title suggests, this is just part one of a bigger film. And they're also going to be doing extended cuts of both films as well. So this is just sort of the first look at this. We are going to get an extended cut at some point later next year, I think. Probably, I think after we've seen part two, then they'll both get extended cuts.
First of all, I don't understand why he does a cut at the same time a director's cut. That seems weird and counterproductive to me. But I know that fans really love that. But it just usually that happens because the cut you've put out, you're dissatisfied with and you want to add more. But here he's doing them at the same time, which is a weird concept, but we will see if that's something that's really successful. Because I think, you know, we talked to him, didn't we? We had breakfast with Zack Snyder, and he was saying that what he's putting out now is a certain sort of certification, and the next one will be harder and a bit meaner and a bit dirtier and a bit grittier. So that's what we've got to look forward to. Does this work as it is? You know, often, as I say, the director's cut has come because it was a dissatisfactory thing that we had to begin with. How does this rate? How do you like this?
Well, the main thing I sort of felt like I noticed on that front is it occasionally feels like it pulls some punches in terms of the violence. Like, it's rated 15, but there are times where I almost expected a bit more violence and things like that. So I don't know if we will get that in the extended cut, perhaps. On its own terms, I actually, like, again, this is another one, I'm going slightly against the grain here, but because it got quite a savaging from critics when the reviews came out in line with the sort of cinema release last week. But I actually thought it was fine. Like, the characterization and plot leave a bit to be desired. There's not really much meat on the bone there. And you don't really ever get a true sense of, like, why it's these people that have been picked and assembled and why they've kind of chosen to come along for the fight, I didn't think. But at the same time, I did think it was a very, very impressively rendered world. I actually thought, on the most part, the VFX were very good. This robot character played by Anthony Hopkins, I thought, like, just the VFX there were just so, like, when you just see something and it's hard to believe it's not a physical thing there in the world. It just felt very big. Like, I mean, I did have this advantage, as I've said already, of seeing it on an IMAX screen, but it felt like it warranted being up there on the cinema screen. Actually, I'm surprised it hasn't got a bit of a bigger cinema rollout, actually, for that reason, just because all the budget's up there on screen to see, and you know, you do get these huge spaceships, you get big fights. Obviously, again, there's very much the Zack Snyder style things going on, like the slow-mo and the speed ramping and things. So if you're not keen on those, it's not going to win you over. But I think if you like his stuff, there's certainly enough to enjoy here.
Yeah, and also it is a planned double bill. There will be yes. Rebel Moon 2 coming and when?
That comes in April next year, Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver. I mean, we've had so many Part 1s this year, haven't we, with Mission Impossible and Spider-Verse
yeah,
among them. But this one, I thought it was felt satisfying enough. Like, you know, you felt that you got enough of that ending with still obviously more to play for in the next part. And I always come away from these kind of films feeling a bit like, well, I've got to reserve some judgment for when I see the next part as well, because you do feel that you haven't had the complete experience yet. I mean, and then for this, we'll obviously be reserving some judgment until the director's cuts come out as well.
Yeah, exactly.
But I thought it was fine. I think, especially if you're kind of thinking about it from the perspective of slapping this on your Netflix, like if you've get to the point over the Christmas break where you've watched a few too many Christmas movies, I think, you know, it's perfectly like, you know, for getting it delivered straight to your TV. It's entertaining and diverting enough. Again, just purely from an action and visual perspective, it's you know, it's enjoyable enough. And then it's one of those weird things where to perhaps sound very harsh by saying this, but I feel like you could call it like a B-list cast in many ways. Like none of the names listed are A-listers, but I actually think it's quite well cast in the sense that Sofia Boutella's always good at this sort of thing and feels like someone who should be a bit more famous and a bigger name than she is. Perhaps Jarman Hounsou as well, I always find him good value. And then Charlie Hunnam as well, I think he never quite broke into the A-list. His blockbusters like King Arthur didn't quite work out, but I thought he had a nice kind of roguish quality here. He's clearly sort of...
He's the Han Solo guy.
Yeah, exactly. He's riffing on the Han Solo, one of this collective. And then someone else who, again, I always think is good value is Ed Skrein. I don't know what it is. I've just always kind of like what he does. And always he seems like one of those people, again, not by any means A-list, and didn't really kind of, you know, break out after being the villain in the first Deadpool. I don't know what it is, but he to me, I think if you can't afford Jude Law, he's a good a good kind of stand in, I think.
Aww.
And I like him, yeah. So sort of enjoyed him as the sort of primary villain. That there's someone sort of higher ranking than him, but he's sort of, I mean, calling the Vader would be saying too much, but I mean, like, he's the Vader to someone else's emperor in a sense. But
yes,
I actually enjoyed him in it as well. I think he understood the assignment, as they say, and delivered to the material. So all this said, I wasn't blown away by it. I didn't think it was amazing, but I actually thought it was it's very solid.
Very solid. Okay, Zach, it's very solid. You've got, you know, your director's cut to up that from very solid, and then part two, and the director's cut of part two. So by the time we've got four films, we might be much higher than solid. Who knows? But if you fancy Rebel Moon, it is on Netflix from Friday. Right, Under the Sea now with this.
Half a billion people from every known species in the sea call this place home. But that doesn't mean they all like me.
I'm gonna kill Aquaman and destroy everything he holds dear. I'm gonna murder his family and burn his kingdom to ash.
So this is Aquaman 2, or its longer title, Aquaman the Lost Kingdom. Matt, obviously we quite enjoyed Aquaman 1, didn't we, with its bongo playing octopus, etc. A light-hearted, fun installment in the DC universe. Here we are back again after some delay, and also the final installment of this current iteration of DC. Tell us where we find Aquaman and what's going on in his life.
So yes, so this is the direct sequel to Aquaman, the standalone film for Jason Momoa's DC superhero. He obviously debuted in Zack Snyder's films, but then he got his solo movie after that. And I think to date, the first Aquaman is still the biggest DC film. So it crossed $1 billion at the box office.
It was hugely popular.
And it was massive. It kind of arrived at a time where I think maybe there wasn't a huge amount of competition over that Christmas break, but it was obviously a massive hit. And this one picks up directly after that. And if, like me, you haven't revisited the first film since it came out of the cinema, it pretty much catches you up anyway. And so if you haven't seen the first film, you're be all right turning up to this one. It catches you up with the main info you need to know, which is that Arthur Curry, aka Aquaman, he is the king of Atlantis now, but given his, you know, personality and what we know of him, he's not loving the job. It's a bit boring for him. He's not enjoying all the bureaucracy and red tape in his underwater kingdom. He and Mera, played by Amber Heard, have had a baby, so he's kind of, you know, adjusting to fatherhood as well. Meanwhile, his nemesis, David Kane, known as the Black Manta, who's played by Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, and you may remember him having this crazy sort of helmet on his super suit that's this really sort of oversized bug head that he's got. He's still seeking revenge on Aquaman. And how this story really gets going is that, looking to fix his Black Manta supersuit, David Kane, he's sort of searching for some Atlantean tech, and he stumbles upon this icy kingdom and his mission to find this tech. There he gets this mysterious black trident, which kind of comes with its own powers and sort of psychically hooks him up to some sort of evil being and some dodgy past things that have been going on there. So there's that to contend with, because he's got these powers and now he wants to seek his revenge on Aquaman, who, as flashbacks handily remind us, killed his dad in the first film. And you may also remember from the first film that Aquaman's brother Orm, played by Patrick Wilson, who had been ruling Atlantis, he's now sort of in prison, and Aquaman might just have to break him out to seek his help, as he seems to be, it's one of those situations where he's a baddie, but he's the only one who may know where Black Manta would be going on his, you know, part of his misdeeds. They form an uneasy alliance. And
sounds familiar, this, doesn't it? Sounds very familiar.
Very familiar. Like, I mean, it sounds a lot like what happened with Loki, really, in the Marvel films. And they do even name check Loki. There's sort of, you know, a lot of that irreverent Aquaman humor. They name check Loki, which, you know, I kind of thought, fair enough, but it does really feel like that, where you've got this antagonist turn sort of anti-hero. And I mean, they're brothers as well. So, like,
and, you know, a brother in prison that, you know, that they'd fought over the crown. One of them ended up in prison. The one that is the uneasy wearer of the crown has to bust the other one out of a prison in order to go on an adventure, to have like daddy issues, to go into different sort of dimensions in terms of different worlds. It's so familiar to the sort of Marvel version of this. But is it up to that standard?
No, as much as I like Patrick Wilson, the character just isn't as interesting or intriguing or as fun as Loki. He's a bit of a boring character, really. So there's not that element to it where you kind of root for that character. And you, I mean, with Loki, you just wanted to spend more time with him really as soon as you met him. But I just don't think that's quite the same with Orm. This film was a very mixed bag for me, because I wasn't an absolute lover of the first one, but I had a fun time with it. And this one, I sort of had lowish expectations. I think partly because, as you mentioned, Jane, this is now really the final film in the DCEU before kind of 2025 comes around and James Gunn and Peter Safran relaunch their DCU with, you know, all new casting and, you know, a new Superman and all that. You're kind of aware it's coming to an end. And we've had four DCEU films this year, starting with Shazam Fury of the Gods, and we had The Flash and Blue Beetle. And earlier on this year, there was a vague feeling that maybe these characters could still appear in James Gunnverse. But as time's gone on, it's just been really clear that no, they're just wrapping it up. So it loses that thing that a lot of modern superhero films have, where they fit into a bigger picture. You kind of feel like this is coming to an end. There were things I kind of enjoyed about it. Like, I do just like Momoa kind of just seemingly playing himself and just having a laugh. And right from the very opening sort of catch-up montage scene, where we see him kind of fighting pirates whilst balancing his duties as a new dad, I did actually enjoy that opening scene. And it doesn't take itself at all seriously. Like, he's kind of saying, like, I talk to fish, and he's enjoying like kicking ass and taking names there. And he, you know, I sort of like that. And it's over the top in every way, really, in the sense that they just keep going to these different parts of the kingdom, and they just keep throwing big, weird, ugly monsters at them. I got through on that level, but it felt derivative. It felt like a bit of a sort of shrug of a sequel, in a way, where a lot of it felt familiar from other films. Like, mentioned the Loki thing already, there was a kind of thing that felt familiar from Iron Man. There was a music cue that very much reminded me of Guardians of the Galaxy. So I thought that felt a bit odd, that those kind of Marvel references in this DC film. Yeah, and then it just felt like we've got the same villain in the form of Black Manta, and then Orm being back. I think Yahya Abdul-Mateen is like a really charismatic actor, but I just don't think this has been his best role by any means. Perhaps I slightly preferred him here than I did in the first one, but still not a great role. And it's just a bit of a kind of, I guess when you get a sequel, like this kind of superhero sequel, you just want a new villain, don't you? And so you don't get that. There's this kind of like sort of almost Army of the Dead type element. They had like an interesting look, and I enjoyed that over the top nature, but I didn't think any of the action scenes lived up to the first film, where there was a couple of really inventive ones in the first film, such as like when the lighthouse gets attacked and Nicole Kidman sort of kicks ass in the first film. That was just really dynamic. And then also that sort of rooftop villa chase you had as well, that just felt like really, really kinetic and fast and a bit different to, you know, how you've seen action scenes at that stage before. Whereas this didn't really have any of that. And it was a lot of the times very much a case of like pixel soup, where you just felt like there was just a lot of CGI. It didn't feel like anything really was real most of the time. When you get to that stage, this is something I always struggle with, and I think you do as well, Jane, but when it's clearly just digital doubles whooshing around, flinging around. So there's no kind of weight to the fights, and it kind of takes away any of that really believable sense of danger when there's just clearly not real people involved. It's all like clearly just these video game avatars duking it out. It passed the time well enough for me in that sense, but it was a bit of a sort of disappointing end for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's 2 hours long. And I know we often talk about running times, but it does seem like too much of it for a start. Also, you know, we always talk about this as well, embargoes and when we see films. And this film was not shown to anyone till the night before it's released, and no one is allowed to talk about it until hours before it's released. There was no real access to anybody working on it. That could be because of some issues surrounding cast members that have made it legally complicated and sort of a bit of a PR minefield, or it could be because they know this is not that good. And I would err on the side of them knowing that this is not that good. I mean, for me, this was a real damp squib of a washout. It was a wet entry. You know, see where I'm going with this? Just really, really not a fitting end to this DCU. For me, I wanted something fast, fun, a little bit sort of spiky, which is what I felt the first one was. This wasn't any of those things. And, you know, like you talk about pixel soup, this was dreadful in that respect. Just an absolute blur of CG nonsense in the creatures, so that what they're up against, you just can't give a toss about. Even if you see a little figure running across a sort of vista, they've got that jerky sort of computer game movement, so you just don't believe they're actually in it. I know they filmed in Hawaii. Can you tell? You can't, because there's that much CG loaded on it. You've no idea whether any of it's green screen or real. Momoa seems sort of defeated by it to me. He has so much charisma and personal charm. Look at how he basically heavy lifted the Fast and the Furious entry recently. He's so good when he wants to be. In this, he's literally turning up in his own clothes and rings, drinking Guinness. Oh my God, the Guinness ad placement in this is insane. And just not even getting any of those one-liners to zing. The jokes fall flat. The comedy is just not there. There's no chemistry between him and Patrick Wilson, God bless him. The costumes look cheap. The sets are sort of kind of hokey. Henchmen that can't act their way out of a paper bag. It just is like watching Cliff Beasts, you know, the film that they're making in the bubble. It's that level of what really? And yeah, and the end note, you know, you do get a postscript on this. You get a little end credit sizzle, but it's not anything that's going to set your world on fire. It's just another additional joke of a joke.
It's a throwaway gag, isn't
that
it?
That wasn't even funny in the first place.
And so that's mid credits as well, isn't it? So you don't, and we stayed to the bitter end
we
just in case
end.
There was a, I thought there might have been a final sort of send off note for this DCU, but no, it's just a little throwaway gag in mid credits.
Just fades to black. And honestly, yeah, this was such a disappointment for me. I would say don't bother going to see this at the cinema. Yeah. I'd wait for this on a streamer if you're a completist, because honestly, I don't think it's going to give you the thrill you want.
I mean, we if we're talking about sort of family cinema outings at Christmas, Wonka feels like a much safer bet than this to me, really, in terms of sort of satisfying the family. This one's quite scary in places, isn't it? Almost. I mean, scary. I mean, as far as these films go, it's got some verging on horror kind of imagery. You can see James Wan's kind of leaning into that a little bit. But
yeah, I mean, demonic possession and shenanigans and like hideous flowers that eat you and those sort of things.
People
turning
into kind of skeletons and things.
Yeah, it could be alarming for little kids, whereas your chocolate might be a better bet.
For the much younger ones, I was kind of thinking for that. It's not like it's a particularly challenging 12A or anything, but it's strange because, yeah, as you say, I actually, in defence, because I just enjoy Momoa a lot, I kind of just enjoyed him doing his thing and not really taking it seriously. But all the other humour and sort of one-liners fell flat. There's something I kind of enjoyed about seeing Nicole Kidman back. You do have a slight feeling of what she's doing here. I completely forgot Dolph Lundgren was in it as well in the first one.
In a vibrant red wig.
Really ridiculous costume. So in a way, there's like a silliness to that that I can't hate it too much because of that. And then like, he's got this cephalopod along to help him. He's got this giant...
It's not even funny. And it doesn't play the bongos.
But he's got this giant seahorse that he rides around as well. In some ways, when something is just so silly, I can't sort of feel too harshly towards it. But
it doesn't feel like anyone else was in on the joke. You know what I mean? Like you mentioned Nicole Kidman there. She's delivering just really po-faced lines about, and let's talk about the messaging in this. There's this laboured message about global warming and taking care of the environment that is so ham-fistedly handled. And Nicole has to deliver lines like, you know, we have minutes to save the world. And she does it completely straight. And I feel like Momoa got a note that no one else did. And there's tonally, it's all off. He got
Story credit, didn't he?
Yeah. Like, love him to death. But maybe Jason shouldn't have been in the writer's room. Do you know what I mean? Because it just doesn't seem to be very cohesive or brisk. I'm annoyed about this.
I think another slight problem with it as well is we've obviously mentioned this, the sort of things that make you think of Marvel movies. And then it was a bit sort of Lord of the Rings in places, like you feel like they've been watching Lord of the Rings. It was a bit Attack of the Clones in some places for me as well. Like when they go and visit some of these characters, that it's very much just like, right, onto the next bit, very sort of episodic in them sort of finding their way towards Black Manta and what he's up to. There's one time they meet this character, which I had no idea until the credits that he was voiced by Martin Short. But he really reminded me of a character that like Obi-Wan and Anakin would have met on their travels in Attack of the Clones. It did feel a bit of a mishmash of other films, really. Like, and I felt like the world felt richer in the first film, really. Felt like we got more of a sense of that underwater kingdom. It was a bit Star Wars prequels in this underwater council that they have as well. That
yes,
Aquaman keeps running into with the underwater bureaucracy. So yeah, it just felt like a lot of other films. It didn't go where you kind of hope it might go after, you know, enjoying the first Aquaman.
And also since then we've had the Black Panther sequel that had an underwater kingdom that was, I think, better realised and had a clearer route for its hero. Whereas I didn't really understand Orms, what he was actually trying to do and what his motivation was. I didn't really understand what Aquaman was really trying to do. And also then they've got all these mixed messages about like, save the environment, don't destroy stuff. And yet it's fine to actually blow the hell out of, you know, landscapes, ice worlds and everything else. You know, and then at the beginning, you know, he's talking about how much he loves his wife and child. And at various stages he says, stay away from my child, stay away from my wife. But ultimately, when it comes down to it, legs it and leaves them to die in a huge explosion. Not bothered about them. No spoilers. But like, none of this is consistent. None of it. It feels like a real, let's just throw it together, shove it out, and then we're done with it. I mean, I guess we should be grateful that Warner Brothers didn't scrap it for tax purposes, because that could have been on the cards. But here we are. We have it. It's in cinemas. Do you think then people should be wonkering it instead of this and saving this for small screen?
If you're making one cinema outing with the family this Christmas, what Wonka feels like the safest bet to me. But then again, this has Nicole Kidman on a underwater jet ski shark type mobile. So, I mean, how wrong can you go with that?
Very, apparently. yeah, I would say this is one to skip. I think if you're already sad about the DC decline of this particular iteration, this isn't going to make you any happier or make you think, oh, wow. In fact, it's probably going to do the opposite and make you think, yep, bring it on, Gunn. We really do need to revive this and retool it and start it for a new generation. Sorry, Aquaman. Sorry, Jason Momoa. But, you know, I feel like he's got a lifetime supply of Guinness out of it, so he's probably happy.
There's these persistent rumours that he may come back as the DC character Lobo as well in the reinvented world. So it might not be the last we'll see of him in DC in general. But I mean, even the way he's been talking recently in interviews, it does sound like he's kind of thinking of this as probably his last Aquaman outing.
Bring him back in Fast and the Furious. That's what I say. I'm all for that. Can't wait for that to come. Okay, so that is Aquaman, and that is out in cinemas now. Also, we saw it in 3D. That wasn't even much cop either. That felt like some sort of weird throwback to an alternate time. Like, who's doing 3D movies now? And also, it didn't feel especially essential or good.
With pretty much all 3D, really, that I thought this was fine to begin with. But as always, I then just got used to it and didn't really notice it after a while. But that's, you know, that's how I always tend to feel with 3D.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, so Aquaman is there for the taking if you fancy a dip. Film of the week then, out of all of this selection, Matt, what's it going to be?
So it's going to have to be The Boy and the Heron, I think, for me. It's just in terms of if we're literally talking like the best film of the week. But I did have a lot of fun with Next Goal Wins as well.
Yeah,
but Boy and the Heron's going to be remembered in years to come. I don't think Next Goal Wins will.
Yeah, Next Goal Wins is a great film to watch on a plane. Boy and the Heron is one to watch on a big screen, huge surround sound, and be absolutely open to it. That would be my pick of the week. So that's it. A reminder then, if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier just by subscribing. Press the button now and you're all set. We've got a current issue out on sale, haven't we, Matt? It's our 2024 massive preview and our 2023 review. So find out what our top 50 films were and what's looking good for next year. It's on sale now. Great for a little journey.
Perfect Christmas reading because, I mean, you can just catch up on all the best films maybe that you didn't catch during the year or remind yourself the ones you did love. And then we've got like a massive look ahead to all the exciting stuff coming next year as well, including Rebel Moon Part 2.
Barnstormer. Okay, so before we go, we do have time for a listener's question. I think this must be Boy and Heron related because it says, what sort of bird would you like to inhabit? I don't know whether that means pull on its body as a cloak or literally be a bird. But Matt, what kind of bird? Is there a cinematic bird you'd like to be?
Trying to come to terms with this disturbing question, the first thing that came to mind was, I'd be tempted to say one of the chickens in Chicken Run, actually. Probably
they do have a nice life, don't they?
In Chicken Run, Dawn of the Nugget, which is another thing you'll quite possibly be watching at Christmas, and very enjoyable, I thought. Not as good as the first one, but very, very enjoyable Aardman animation there. At the start, because it picks up where the old one left off, they live in this such idyllic kind of forest world they've kind of built with all these weird mechanical contraptions there. And it just looks so, obviously their peace gets disrupted, otherwise it'd be a boring film, but it just looks so idyllic there that, I mean, I'd happily be one of those chickens once they've escaped and are living there because it just looks like this kind of paradise where they live. Or the second thing that sprung to mind in terms of like if I had to wear a bird costume, Al from Toy Story 2 springs to mind, Al of Al's Toy Barn, because he wears that big chicken suit in the advert. Yeah. So
I could see you in that, Matt. I think you'd
look
good.
At least that would be comfortable, you know, that would be quite a comfortable one to wear. So how about you?
I'd like to be a kestrel flying high, but not Kez, obviously.
No, no.
I'd love to be an owl like Hedwig, but not Hedwig. I don't know. I think I'm just going to go not for a film bird, but just a huge golden eagle. I'm going to be soaring up there. I would love to be a bird for a day, wouldn't you?
You could be one of the eagles from The Lord of the Rings.
There you go. I'll be one of them. I hate The Lord of the Rings, but I'll be an eagle just for that. Yeah, I'd love to fly around, just bob along on the thermals, be magnificent, and then, you know, jump back. If I'm going to wear a bird costume, I could be Hawkman from Black Adam. It's quite a nifty outfit. Or actually, is it really a bird costume? It's not really, but you know Wonder Woman's golden, like,
yeah, I mean, that's
winged outfit.
That's very eagle inspired. I think you can get away with that. Isn't it?
That would be really nice for a Christmas party. All gold, very festive. And then, you know, don't have to worry about transport getting home. Fly home on my golden wings. That's what I'm going to do. So that's nice for me. All right. On that note, I think we'll say goodbye. It is our last podcast next week. It is our review of the year, everything we loved and loathed. So do join us for that before you have your festive dinner. And then after that, it is the new year and we'll be back on January the 3rd. But for now, let's say goodbye, Matt.
Bye.
You can say it in a bird way if you wanted. Bye-bye.
Those faces. I'm driving home for Christmas.